Did you see the story this week about this French science experiment where people had to live in a cave for 40 days without like natural light or mobile phones?
Yes, I've been obsessed with it. And next time they do it, I want to go in the cave.
I am so intrigued to find out like what it did to people to have no sense of time, basically. But anyway, I was watching these like images of these poor volunteers emerging from their cave this week. And I thought it was a very good metaphor for this podcast, Dominic, because we are like guiding people out of the cave of not knowing about what's going on in Europe and dazzling them with the bright light that is our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Is that a good metaphor?
A little bit of a stretch.
Needs a bit of work. I'm going to go back and fine tune it.
It's funny because this week I got a really good present. I got a clock which just says now.
Is that a good present?
So it turns and it just says now, 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 but in Dutch. It's really cool. And I think it fits really nicely with this cave experiment.
Weird bit of trivia for you from the 1990s UK garage scene. Did you know Craig David has a watch that just says now on it with no hands?
Well, me and Craig David are the cool guys.
The cool guys.
Anyway, stepping back into the 21st century for a second, we've got a pretty exciting announcement.
This is the first episode that we're making as part of our new collaboration with other independent media across Europe called Sphera, which literally launched a couple of days ago. So it is hot off the press, but we're going to be working with loads of really cool European media outlets over the next year as part of this collective, including L'Inchiesta in Italy, El Salto in Spain, Street Press in France. And together we're going to be making like videos and podcasts and events. Remember events? It's very, very early days, but it's very exciting. So that is something to look forward to in the coming months. But what do we have to look forward to this week?
Well, today, to celebrate our inauguration as the flagship podcast of Sphera, we're talking about something that I've been wanting to discuss for a while now: cheese diplomacy.
You are obsessed.
I am. It's an issue that perfectly combines two of my biggest addictions, halloumi and EU politics. And that might sound a bit weird, but it's quite complex and actually has some potentially quite serious implications, but it's also fascinating and will leave you with something to chew on. We're going to be joined later on in the show by Natalie Lamprou to talk about halloumi and its country of origin, Cyprus.
But first...
Who has had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for the French town of Travers, just south of Paris. And just to let you know, both of these stories involve rape and sexual abuse. So if that's something that you don't want to hear right now, then it might be good to skip forward about 10 minutes. So, Travers, it is a town of about 30,000 people. It's a kind of leafy, well-to-do commuter belt town. And it witnessed a pretty surreal and chaotic meeting of its town councillors this week. Let's hear a bit of that meeting. Even if you don't speak French, it'll give you an idea of what the tone was like.
Monsieur Damerval, c'est pas à vous de dire comment ça fonctionne dans un conseil municipal, d'accord? Ce n'est pas à vous de le faire.
The reason this meeting was so tense is that it started with a statement on the town budget from the mayor, a guy called Georges Tron, and that would be an entirely normal thing to happen at a town hall meeting. If the mayor wasn't in prison for rape, he is serving a 5-year sentence, 2 years suspended, but 3 years actually behind bars. And it's actually one of his former employees at the town hall who he was convicted in February of raping. And in spite of this, he is insisting on staying in office and running this town from his jail cell. It's absolutely extraordinary. He says he's innocent and he's appealing his conviction. And while he does that, he should be able to carry on working. It's not really clear how much he's able to actually communicate with his staff on a day-to-day basis in prison, or if he has any like internet access. But certainly in this case, he was communicating his wishes to his staff by letter from prison.
Wow, that sounds... like a pretty strange situation.
Yeah, it's crazy. And aside from all the impracticalities of trying to be a mayor in prison, this whole thing must be really upsetting for the woman who was convicted of raping. The left-wing opposition in this town was absolutely furious about it. They've said that Georges Trant no longer has the moral authority to run this town, whatever his own thoughts are about it. Feminist groups are, of course, also furious about it, and they have launched a petition to try and get the government to force him to step down. But they haven't really got very far with that, and that is perhaps partly because Georges Trant had a very famous lawyer to defend him, a guy called Éric Dupond-Moretti, who has a bit of a reputation for making anti-Me Too comments and suggesting that women sometimes make stuff up. And as it turns out, this lawyer is now the justice minister.
Oh.
Yeah. So when the government was challenged over this case in parliament recently and asked why Georges Trant is being allowed to stay in office, the justice minister, who represented the mayor throughout this trial as a lawyer, he said, well, you know, the government's not going to intervene on this. This mayor is appealing his case. And while that appeal is ongoing, he should be allowed to stay in his job and benefit from the presumption of innocence, which is kind of wild. I mean, I'm not a legal expert, as you may have noticed, but the expression in English and also in French is usually innocent until proven guilty. And Georges Trant was found guilty in a court of law. Now the government is saying, yeah, well, you know, even if you are found guilty of rape by a court, if you want to challenge that and try to appeal the verdict, I guess you can stay in your job while you do that. That seems reasonable.
So is this mayor a member of Macron's party?
No, he's not. He's a conservative. He used to be a government minister under Sarkozy back in the day.
Oh, another politician that was sentenced to jail relatively recently.
Yeah, bit of a trend going on here. So no, he's not from the same party. But in general, you know, this doesn't look good for a government that has been saying since the Me Too movement that it's really serious about protecting victims of sexual violence. I think this is probably true in lots of countries, but it still really feels in France like the post-Me Too reckoning is still very much ongoing. There's still a really big conversation going on here about the abuse of power for sexual gratification. And this particular case, the Georges Trant case, it actually dates back years and years, but he only got convicted in February, so it feels really recent. And it had felt like a recent victory for campaigners because Georges Trant was this kind of archetypal person who had held a position of power and then claimed that this position of power had nothing to do with the fact that women who worked for him had gone along with his sexual advances. What happened with at least two of his employees is that he would offer them foot massages and then use that as a pretext for turning it into a sexual encounter. And in the end, he was only convicted of raping one of these women, but he was found guilty in part because the court had recognized that this woman had felt paralyzed in that moment and unable to stop what he was doing because he was her boss and she was worried about her job. So this conviction felt like quite an important moment in recognizing what sexual coercion in the workplace actually looks like. But now it turns out that you can be convicted of raping someone at work and not lose your job as the manager of that workplace, which seems kind of crazy to me. I will say, though, that Georges Trant is jarringly popular in the town itself. He's quite a charismatic politician, and he got re-elected last year by a landslide, despite the court case. And French TV was playing interviews this week of voters in the town being like, oh, I support him all the way. He's a good mayor. And I guess that's just voters. Oh. But yeah, not a great week for the town of Travers, and not a great week for the government either in showing that it's serious about its post-Me Too reckoning. Who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for the German gymnast Sarah Voss after she received widespread praise for taking a stand and defying convention by choosing to wear a full bodysuit whilst competing at the European Artistic Gymnastics Championships in Basel. She made this stand in order to draw attention to what she called the increasing sexualization in gymnastics. Traditionally, gymnasts wear leotards, so outfits that don't cover their legs whilst competing anyway. One of Voss's colleagues actually pointed out that whilst practicing, they almost all wear full body suits anyway. And somehow it's just continued being convention that these gymnasts show more skin whilst they're competing than when they're practicing.
Mm.
Voss described her decision to the German broadcaster ZDF as follows. She said, "We women all want to feel good in our skin. In the sport of gymnastics, it gets harder and harder as you grow out of your child's body. As a little girl, I didn't see the tight gym outfits as such a big deal. But when puberty began, when my period came, I began feeling increasingly uncomfortable."
Mm.
It's quite a powerful statement, I think. And Voss's teammate, Elizabeth Seitz, stressed the vulnerability of the conventional leotard, pointing out that something can always slip, and that it's something she's always been worried about, revealing more than she should from the outfit that she's wearing whilst competing.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I cannot imagine like how stressed I would be having to do my job while wearing a garment like that and just worrying about something falling out of it. So this is really good, and it sounds like it's going to potentially make people feel more comfortable while doing their jobs as gymnasts, so that's fantastic. But is this actually a first? Is she the first person to do this?
No, but up until now it's only happened when people are covering their bodies for religious reasons. So this is the first time it's been done without there being a religious reason.
And how have the authorities responded to it?
Well, in the past, gymnasts have actually sometimes been deducted points for like adjusting their leotards to make themselves more comfortable during a performance. So the conventions around this are pretty strict. But pleasingly, FOSS received quite a lot of support internationally, and importantly also from the German Gymnastics Federation. And actually, the international rules aren't as strict as it might seem, considering the convention. You don't actually have to wear a normal leotard. You are allowed to wear a full-length leotard, whatever your reasons, so long as it is elegant in style.
Okay, who decides what's elegant and what's not elegant?
Yeah, I don't know. The elegance police? But it's one of those things that's just been a convention and nobody had done it yet. So being the first to stick your neck out is obviously quite a brave thing to do. Voss was supported by two of her teammates who later on in the competition also decided to wear full-length outfits. And they did this all because of sexualization in gymnastics. And it's pretty bad, and it has been pretty bad for decades. You've probably heard about one of the most shocking cases, which came from the USA gymnastic team, where Larry Nassar, the longtime USA team doctor, who is now sitting in jail, sexually abused many, many, mainly underage girls over decades.
Mm-hmm.
But this is by no means the only case of sexual abuse in gymnastics. And there are sadly many allegations, not all of a sexual nature, in European gymnastics as well. In the UK, there's currently a review taking place looking into British gymnastics. In March, they released an interim report which said that they'd identified 90 clubs and 100 coaches through their report so far, and they'd already referred 39 cases to the police.
Wow.
There's also a report due in the Netherlands looking into allegations of abuse and unacceptable behaviour from coaches within Dutch gymnastics, which is actually being released this week. It should be out by the time this episode is out as well. And actually, just this month, a group of 22 Greek gymnasts, female and male, wrote a letter to their prime minister and president accusing coaches of decades of abuse and neglect. So it seems pretty horrifyingly widespread abuse within gymnastics. And they're just three examples of European countries. If you look at most European countries, you can find cases. Obviously, gymnasts choosing whether or not to wear a full-length bodysuit isn't going to eradicate this abuse. And Sarah Voss stressed that she herself had never been abused, but she's aware that she and her colleagues are role models for younger gymnasts, and she hopes that younger gymnasts will see this action that she and her colleagues have taken, and that it will help encourage everyone to stand up for themselves.
This week, four people did the right thing and signed up to support this podcast so that we can keep making it for those lovely little ears on the side of your head.
The right thing.
Definitely the right thing. Who are these lovely people, Dominic?
They are Sean McGann, Amber Minogue, Samantha Reynolds, and Valerie Vargo. Thank you so much to you four and to everyone else who is continuing to support us at the moment. We really wouldn't be doing this without your support. You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You could get a voicemail from us, an angry Macron bag, even a postcard from Amsterdam and Paris. Have a look and see what you can donate. We'd be ever so grateful.
Would it be going too far to say that your love of halloumi is one of your defining characteristics as a person?
That's really nice of you to say that. Yes.
It's one of the first things I learned about you. Like, you talk about halloumi alarmingly often. And I have to say, and this is kind of sacrilegious for someone who lives in France, I do sometimes think that all cheese should just be halloumi. It is so delicious.
And this is why we're friends, because halloumi makes up about 50% of my diet.
That's not good.
I know, it's really not good. It's really fatty.
Do you reckon everyone knows what halloumi is by now, or should we say?
Yeah, maybe they don't. I mean, I grew up in London, which is a kind of halloumi bubble, and in my echo chamber everyone knew what halloumi was, but as soon as I moved to the Netherlands I couldn't find it in supermarkets. I discovered that loads of people don't even know what it is. I've been a kind of halloumi evangelist here. I even had a halloumi bar at my wedding, where like there was a bar where you could buy drinks and a bar where you could get given halloumi freshly fried.
I missed that.
Did you?
I feel like I've been cheated. So like, can you describe it for people who haven't tasted it?
Yeah, so it's a Cypriot cheese. It's made up of a combination of sheep, goat, and sometimes cow milk. On continental Europe, apparently it's mainly cow milk because the Cypriot cheesemakers think we won't be able to deal with the more pungent stuff. It's pretty salty. And the thing that makes it stand out from other cheese is it has a very high melting point. So when you're cooking it, it doesn't melt entirely. It just softens. Mm. And it's known for having a texture that kind of squeaks between your teeth. And it's just the most delicious thing to have ever been invented.
It sounds gross when you say that it squeaks against your teeth, but it is so satisfying. Thank you very much for that halloumi summary, Dominic.
Thank you. I could talk about it for hours. You have to stop me.
It's your calling in life. So as you said, halloumi comes originally from the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. It is called halloumi in Greek, but helim in Turkish. Both languages are spoken on the island. And there was big news recently on the halloumi front, in that the European Union has announced that this cheese is going to be given a special status called Protected Designation of Origin. And what this means is that if you're a cheesemaker, you can only call it halloumi if you're making it in Cyprus. It's a bit like how champagne can only be called champagne if it's from the Champagne region of France. One of my favorite ones of these is feta cheese. Like, you know how in the supermarket, you'll often find this cheese labeled salad cheese.
That's why. Oh, I'd never put two and two together.
That's why. It looks just like feta cheese, but they can't call it feta cheese. So back to this big halloumi announcement. It's something that's been celebrated by some people because it's good advertising for the cheese and for Cyprus. But this actually goes far beyond the cheese. It has political ramifications. As you know, Cyprus is a divided island. Part of it is run by a Greek Cypriot administration, which is part of the EU. But part of it is run by a Turkish Cypriot administration. It's been like this since there was a military coup by the Greek army and then a Turkish invasion in 1974. And since then, the political situation has stabilized into this kind of deadlock. No country in the world recognizes the Turkish Cypriot administration as a legitimate government, apart from Turkey. And the Turkish side of the island doesn't recognize the Greek side's EU membership. So it's very complicated. And this week, yet another set of talks started in Geneva to try and find some kind of resolution to the situation. So where does the cheese come in? The reason that some people are seeing this cheese announcement as good news is that Turkish Cypriot producers are for the first time going to be able to sell their cheese into the EU, which is brilliant because this is a hipster cheese and now they'll have access to this huge market of people who just love hipster cheeses and are waiting to discover it. So it seems like it's good for business, and the EU has been promoting it as maybe not something that will solve Cypriot politics alone, but something that is a positive step for reconciliation. Not everyone is happy about it, though, and some Turkish Cypriot politicians are very unhappy about it. The foreign minister has said that it is a disgraceful attempt to dominate how things work on the Turkish side, because the cheesemakers are going to have to start paying attention to food safety standards that are dictated by the EU and the Greek side. So it's very complicated, and we have been trying for a long time to work out who was the best person to talk about this. And suddenly we realised that the answer was actually right there in front of us. Natalie Lamprou. Natalie is one of our Patreon supporters. She is a Cypriot journalism student and podcaster living in Germany. She's also written really beautifully about Cypriot identity and what it means to be Cypriot. And we had a feeling that she would be the perfect person to talk to because she would humour our like weird combination of questions about cheese and politics. And it turns out that we were right. So here is that very fun conversation about cheese and diplomacy and Cypriot identity. I hope you enjoy it. For listeners who aren't familiar with the situation, I know it's a really complicated thing to ask you, but what is it like on a daily basis? Is it possible to have friends on the Greek side if you're living on the Turkish side? Can you live on one side but work on the other side? What's it like?
Growing up on the island, it's kind of almost surreal because you kind of know that it's a divided island. You see military bases everywhere. You have the buffer zone, but you don't really understand what it really means, or at least I didn't when I was younger. I knew some Turkish Cypriots who would go to school in the south from where I'm from, but not too many. I didn't really interact with them a lot. So it was really surreal. I didn't really understand what it meant until I grew up and actually left the country and kind of realize how ridiculous it is that we're all Cypriots, but we don't really know each other. The borders between the Republic of Cyprus and the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus opened in 2004, which, you know, since then we've been able to kind of visit the north. We went there with my grandparents and my family, and we got to see my dad's childhood home in Morfu. But yeah, Greek Cypriots don't tend to live there or do a lot of business over there. But then when Turkish Cypriots come to us or to the south, they do work there, some of them. Some of them go to school there. They also have the right to Cypriot citizenship. So if they want that, that's available to them, although I'm not sure how difficult and complicated it is for them to actually get it. But yeah, interaction is very sort of minimal and doesn't happen on a daily basis for sure.
And so to what extent does it feel like Cypriots from both sides manage to have a shared identity, given that the island is divided in this way?
In general, there's kind of this sense of loss in terms of, you know, what really defines us as Cypriots. And our long history of being colonized by everyone from the Arabs to the Byzantine Empire to the Ottomans to the British Empire, yeah, that doesn't really help, as you can probably imagine. And that's kind of what makes Halimi special, right? I mean, it's almost a unifier because it's ours. It's just purely Cypriot, right? It's not something that belongs to the Turkish Cypriots or something that belongs to the Greek Cypriots. It doesn't belong to the Brits and it doesn't belong to the Greeks. And yeah, it belongs to us. It's a purely Cypriot food. And I think that's what makes it special.
So the EU has given halloumi / helim this protected designation of origin status. And they're pitching this decision as something that could bring the island together, because they've given the Turkish name protected status as well. Do you think that there is any sense behind this argument that the decision from the EU could help the reconciliation process between the Turkish north and the Greek south?
Well, it's a bit of an overstatement, but I guess I understand where it's coming from. It is a small step in progress, for sure. The way that the European Commission did it is they actually made sure that both communities will benefit from this designation, because you have to realize that the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus is not actually an internationally recognized state, which effectively makes international trade and relations with other countries extremely difficult, complicated, impossible at times. So by making it possible for Turkish Cypriot producers to pass the cheese through the green line, which is the buffer zone between the two communities, it means that they can export to the European Union as well. So yeah, they're allowing the Turkish Cypriots to benefit from this economically as well. And it kind of pushes us to work together in a small way, if it may be, but still definitely progress.
Beyond this cheese, is there any shared culture between both sides of the island?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, before the division of the island in 1974, I have personally not experienced this because I'm young, but the communities used to live together. If you listen to our languages, which both our dialects, so Cypriot Greek and Cypriot Turkish, they're quite different to their like mainland versions of the language. And we have a lot of common words. You know, we use some Turkish words. They've adopted some Greek words. And our cuisine is basically the same. I think the only difference is that Greek Cypriots eat pork and Turkish Cypriots don't because of religious reasons. But yeah, I mean, we look the same. We are the same people.
I'm sorry to take things back to a stupid cheese question again.
Halloumi is never stupid. Go.
But is it true to say, I mean, the EU is pitching this as a foodstuff that genuinely crosses the political divide and is universally enjoyed as a food? Do Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots enjoy halloumi in the same way? Do they cook it in the same way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's actually this Instagrammer, Melise. She's a Turkish Cypriot and she does food blogging. And her feed is full of halloumi. And that kind of also made me realize, like, it's not just us. Like, they love it as well. But yeah, I mean, I know that they eat it with watermelon in the summer, which is how we eat it. It's like the best sort of summer lunch to have when it's 40 degrees Celsius outside. We grill it. They also age it, which is not a version of the cheese that's exported to the West, although it's very delicious. And I highly recommend you try it if you ever get the opportunity. But yeah, it's definitely a common cultural piece of food that we both share.
Cheese aside, do you look at unification in Cyprus as something that is even plausible one day, or have you just given up hope that that will ever happen?
I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, the last time we had big talks on the reunification was in 2017 at Transmontana. Those talks completely collapsed. Nothing came out of it. And we have new talks coming up on April 27th. It's the Geneva 5+1. It's led by the UN. And they're sort of inviting representatives from the Republic of Cyprus, Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, Greece, UK, and Turkey to informally discuss or like restart negotiations for reunification. This keeps happening every couple of years. And every couple of years, both sides come out and start blaming each other and saying that nothing came out of it. But what makes things especially scary right now, or disheartening even, is that Erdogan has really, really started sort of meddling in the politics again. He's advocating for a two-state solution. The new president in the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, Ersin Tatar, who was elected in November last year, is also an advocate for a two-state solution. And if that happens, there's no turning back. There's no reunification. It will never be possible. So I honestly have no idea how these talks are going to go, but I don't have much hope that they're going to go well. There are also rumors on the Greek Cypriot part that our president, Nikos Anastasiadis, actually, behind closed doors, is also advocating for a two-state solution, although publicly he doesn't say this.
Do most Cypriot, like normal Cypriot people on both sides, would they prefer to be a united island? Or do you think most people would prefer just to have two separate states?
It really depends on who you talk to. I mean, this divide between the right and the left is basically everywhere nowadays, is very prominent in Cyprus. It always has been. So you'll get a lot of Greekophiles, I call them, on the Greek Cypriot side who advocate for enesis with Greece and just sort of keep saying that we're Greek and these Turkish Cypriots have nothing to do with us, whatever. And they don't really see a reason for reunification. They want their land back in the north. They want the homes that they lost, but they could care less about Turkish Cypriots, who should not be ignored. And then you also have people who generally tend to lean more to the left, who are advocates for bicommunal peace and a federal solution to the division. You have the same situation with Turkish Cypriots. You know, you have some people who lean more to the right, who are more Turkey-friendly, and then others who advocate for, a federal solution. But there's a huge momentum right now on the island. There are a lot of grassroots organizations like Unite Cyprus Now and HADE. And they're just young activists who are going out on the streets. They actually have a protest coming up this weekend. And they're sort of trying to apply more pressure on the government to basically do what they promise and make a federal solution possible.
Natalie, before you go, could you tell us what your favorite way of preparing halloumi is?
Okay, a bit unorthodox, but it's super simple. You just take halloumi, you slice it up, put it on the grill, and cover it in honey. And the honey kind of like crystallizes, and it's so good. Like the sweetness and the saltiness, it's delicious. Highly recommended.
If you're listening to this, you're clearly someone who enjoys a good European podcast. So you should check out Natalie's. It is called Everest, and it is about making European politics sexy. A noble goal, if ever there was one. You should check it out. The link is in the show notes, along with the link to that lovely blog post that she wrote about Cypriot identity. What have you been reading or watching this week?
I watched the Oscar-nominated Romanian documentary Collective this week. It didn't win either of the Oscars it was nominated for, but don't let that stop you watching it immediately. Yeah, I must say I was somewhat reluctant to put this on, knowing that It was a film looking at corruption in the healthcare system uncovered in the aftermath of a horrifying fire in a club in Bucharest. But I'm very pleased I did watch it because I thought it was one of the best films I've seen in a long time. It's a sort of journalistic political thriller that follows a group of investigative journalists at a sports daily newspaper. And it reminded me a bit of some of my favourite iconic investigative journalism movies like Spotlight or All the President's Men. Except in this case, the film is a documentary. The director, Alexandre Nano, tells the story without any narration or talking heads, and in a way that just had me absolutely gripped, and you kind of forget that it's a documentary at certain moments. There are some incredibly dark things uncovered by the journalists, but the film also left me mainly uplifted and inspired to watch these people who are fighting so hard to try and make their country work better. It's currently available to rent online in a lot of the world. It cost me about €4 to rent, and it was well worth those €4.
I can't wait to watch this. I'm going to check it out this week.
What did you enjoy this week, Katie?
After recommending you a book from 1956 a few weeks back, I'm on a bit of a push to give you more futuristic recommendations. So I've got a virtual reality experience for you this week.
Ooh.
I actually stole this from Are We Europe's newsletter, which you should all subscribe to, by the way, because it's very, very good. But through this newsletter, I stumbled across something called Pollinator Park this week. Have you come across it?
No, I haven't.
So Pollinator Park is a virtual reality website where you can take a tour of this futuristic insect park. Sounds really weird, but stay with me. And basically, it's set in a future Europe where we have killed all of the bees and the other pollinating insects. And in this kind of dystopian, beeless world, the park has become a kind of safe haven for insects. And you can tour this place by like dragging the mouse along the screen and looking at all the flowers. It feels a bit like you're on a school trip because it gives you lots of activities to do. It's like, now pick up this wand and pollinate the flower. So it's really fun, and I ended up spending slightly too much time on it. It's funny because it's quite relaxing as an experience, but also really unsettling at the same time because you are contemplating a future without bees. Also, this whole thing was paid for by the EU, and I have like so many questions about how the EU ended up funding a virtual reality website about bees. But it's very cool. It's definitely worth your time, especially if you have kids or if you are a kid like me.
Sounds to me like a very good use of EU money. My happy ending this week is kind of a happy ending mashup with isolation inspiration, because I saw this week that a new film festival has been launched online that has a pretty unique goal that fits well into this segment. It features films that celebrate people finding happiness in a myriad of different and diverse ways. The film festival is called the Feel Good Film Festival, and it will provide you with a collection of the world's best short feel-good films to be watched from the comfort of your own sofa. It's quite a simple concept, but something that I think many of us could do with these days. The organisers describe it as the cinematic equivalent of a bowl of ice cream, sunshine on your face, or a long hot bath.
Ooh, lovely.
I'm going to be buying me my £10 ticket to enjoy many a happy and joyful ending. Their first programme has just round up, but they have a second selection of films coming from the 7th to the 11th of May, and they can be enjoyed all across the world, except for the US and Australia. Sorry, sad ending for you guys.
Sorry, guys. You and I have been very bad at posting on social media this week, but some people who are much better at posting on social media are our new partners at Sphera. So don't forget to check them out. We are super excited to be joining this new collective of independent European media outlets doing many things in many languages. You can also find us on the social medias. Where are we, Dominic?
We are on Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram at Europeans Podcast, Facebook, the Europeans Podcast. And that's it, actually, isn't it? You say I'm not allowed to say emails here because it makes me sound like an old person.
It's not a social media. Get with the picture. This podcast is very proud to be a partner of Are We Europe, the wonderful European magazine. You can check them out at areweeurope.com.
Many thanks to our producers this week, Kat Laszlo, Andre Popovicu, and Priyanka Shankar. The music you've heard, those wonderful jingles, are by Jim Barn. except for the one coming out of the Patreon outro, which features the ancient French conch shell, which is by the wonderful Mariska Martinez. Thank you both.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Yes, us.